You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Omar Hassan Ahmad al-Bashir has ruled Sudan since 1989, but how much do we really know about him and the things that have influenced him? Like so many people in the headlines, he remains something of a mystery. So today we start a series called Backstory to answer some of the questions. To help us understand al-Bashir, I'm joined now by Robert Collins, a professor of history emeritus at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He has written seven histories of Sudan and its environments and lived and traveled throughout the country since 1956. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you.
What role did al-Bashir play in the military coup of 1989?
Well, he organized it. He organized and led it. The background of the coup was laid down by Hassan al-Turabi, who was kind of the political mentor of the hardline Islamists in Khartoum. But he carried it out. He planned the military operation, and it was very swiftly done.
And did they share power, Hassan al-Turabi and al-Bashir?
Well, they did until 1999. You have to realize that Hassan al-Turabi was essentially, he was the Islamist ideologue. He was sort of the brains behind this and became one of the leading Islamists. And actually, through his Arab and Israeli Islamic conferences that he held in Khartoum in the early 90s, they were a gathering place for every terrorist on the book. It was a who's who of terrorism. And what he did, he laid down the political background whereby once they seized power, they had a political agenda, which was the Islamization of Sudan. The actual part of it was taken, Bashir carried out the nuts and bolts. Thereafter, they shared power. Turabi liked very much to regard himself as the ideologist, the theoretician, the philosopher of the movement. And he was always very frank about this, and he said, I leave getting it done to other people. In that regard, he meant Bashir. And Bashir, in the early years, was perfectly happy to do just that. In other words, he did all the practical details in implementing what was a revolution, an ideological revolution, while Turabi would bask in the sunshine as the mentor. Now, that worked very well until the end of the, until December, well, really late 1999, when they finally broke. And what Hassan al-Turabi did was, after all those years, he decided that during this time, Bashir had slowly acquired a great deal of power in his office as president. And Turabi, at that point, wanted to curb those powers, and essentially, at that time, he was Speaker of the Assembly, wanted to take Bashir's place, and passed through the National Assembly legislation that would have brought down, really, in fact, turning Bashir into very much a subordinate, just a figurehead. And it's at that time when Bashir moved in with the tanks and the troops and physically removed Turabi and closed the National Assembly.
Has,
and ever since then, Turabi's been in house arrest or jail.
Has al-Bashir continued the ideological part of the regime since he ousted al-Turabi, or have things softened a bit over the years since?
Oh, well, in kind of typical Sudanese fashion, there's a lot of ambiguity about. There's no question that Bashir has softened the regime, particularly after the terrorists attacked the embarrassment of having Osama bin Laden as the guest of the Sudan, who left but finally decided he was no longer wanted in 1996 after the United States and Saudi Arabia failed to take the Sudan's offer of giving them Osama bin Laden. And so,
had he and al-Turabi agreed on keeping Osama there, or was Osama there more because al-Turabi found him a kindred spirit?
Al-Turabi certainly did. When Osama bin Laden came down to Khartoum in the next week, Turabi threw a big reception party for him. Osama bin Laden took it as third wife, Turabi's niece, and they were very close during all these years. But there was an element within the National Islamic Front was the name of the political organization that was carrying out this Islamist revolution. And within that group, there were many becoming concerned that by 1996, Sudan had become a pariah state, not only with the West, but also with their Arab neighbors. And part of the reason was that, one of the reasons, but an important one, was the presence of Osama bin Laden. And they made it very clear. They tried to hand him over, as I said, to the Saudis and the United States government, who refused. The Saudis wouldn't want him stirring up trouble in Saudi Arabia. And the result was that Osama bin Laden decided that his days were numbered, called up his jet, packed up his family, and just departed to the great relief of the Sudanese.
My guest is Robert Collins, who probably knows more about the Sudan than any American traveling there right after Sudan achieved its independence, in fact, a month after independence in 1956, and he has returned regularly to live, travel in every part of the country to carry out his research, the result of any number of books. Wasn't Sudan a democracy before al-Bashir took power? Was it a secular democracy?
Well, it's been a democracy on and off. When the British left, they left a parliamentary government, which was a true democracy, and that proved almost impossible to govern because largely of strong sectarian differences. And the military took over. In the 50 years of the independence of Sudan, only 11 of them have been democratic. The other 32 years have been military dictatorships. The last military dictatorship was overthrown in 1985, and a democratically elected government led by Sadiq al-Mahdi formed a government. And it was that government, the crux of the matter here is that in 1983, President, then the military dictator, President Jaafar Numeri, was losing his political base. And he was very desperate to build up his political base. And in order to satisfy the hardline Islamists, he imposed the Sharia law on all the Sudanese when only two-thirds of the Sudanese are Muslims. And it became very clear, even to Sadiq al-Mahdi, who has a long and famous Islamic tradition, that they simply could not keep this Sharia. And under his democratic rule from 1985 until the coup d'etat in 1989, he worked slowly and gradually, as he always did, to eliminate Sharia, in other words, not make it the law of the land as Numeri had done. This was anathema to the Islamists and to the hardliners, and particularly a man like Bashir, because Bashir was very much a dedicated Muslim to the Islamist brand, but what he really hated were the sectarian units, sectarian brotherhoods in the Sudan. That would be the Ummah and the Ansar on the one hand, and the Khatmi and the Democratic Union on the other, who by and large had controlled the democratic governments. When it looked like the democratic governments, they were going to modify or not make the Sharia pertain to all Sudanese, that triggered the coup. And Bashir put it together within two or three weeks. Much longer he'd been preparing and thinking about that remains unknown. But he had a strong, and has always kept this, is very important to understand that the military, the professional army corps, dislikes and hates the Islamists. And part of the revolution after the coup d'etat in 1989 was to reform the army, that is, to purge the army of its professional officers put in those who were theologically correct and militarily inept, transforming what had been a splendid army into today a kind of rabble in arms. But Bashir, all that time, was very certain to hold the loyalty of the army, and that proved crucial when he put together his strong corps. These of colonels and brigadiers, the younger junior officers, who were very much attracted, like Bashir himself, to the message of Hassan al-Turabi in the Islamists. And they themselves were not so much disenchanted with democracy, but what they did loathe were the sectarian brotherhoods who hitherto had run the Democratic Union, and that triggered the, Sadiq al-Mahdi was going to present legislation to modify or even terminate the Sharia law in the Sudan on, it would be for the 4th of July, I believe. And the coup, that triggered the coup, which, of course, occurred on the night of the 30th of June by junior officers who were not like the senior professionals.
Well, you talked about the imposition of Sharia. What percentage of the Sudanese population is Muslim?
Oh, two-thirds. There's a one-third or not.
So that's a large minority to be told that they have to live under Sharia law. Is that why there has been a civil war in the country for so many years?
Well, let me put it this way. This civil war has been going on since 1955 with an armistice from 1972 until 1983. It's been very vicious since the Civil War recommenced again in 1983. Throughout those long years, there have been numerous, endless attempts to negotiate a ceasefire, to negotiate peace. And after 1983, the year in September when Numeri imposed the Sharia on all Sudanese, from that time on, Sharia was the rock on which all peace negotiations had hitherto foundered, until Sadiq and his democratically elected government had agreed that Sharia had to go. And that was in June of 1989, and that triggered the coup.
Getting back to Omar Hassan.
I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question. Two-thirds of the Sudanese are Muslim, one-third are not.
And I understand about 40% of the country are also Arabs, which means that some of the Muslims are not Arabs, which I think complicates it even more. Sudan being the largest country in Africa, perhaps it would have been better if it had been made into two countries. Is that a reasonable thought?
Well, it certainly is a reasonable thought, because no issue was debated more heavily by the British when they realized after the Second World War that they were going to have to leave sooner than they thought. And they had never paid much attention to the southern Sudan, that is the non-Muslim, very African Sudan. And they'd never paid much attention to it because their eyes were focused on the center in Khartoum. And southern Sudan was so different from the north. And so the British said, what are we going to do? These are two very different countries. Shouldn't we not separate them? And this was an agonizing debate among the British, and they finally reluctantly said, in a kind of charismatic sort of way, well, we inherited the Sudan as one, we should hand it back as one. And there were strong elements in the British Foreign Office who were not going to see the Sudan divided, because if you broke the southern Sudan away, that is where the Nile waters from Lake Victoria pass through. And Egypt was adamantly opposed to having a separate African southern Sudanese government, which could not be controlled by the north, because they were concerned, and they still are, it's still a big issue, about the water. And the water issue bifurcated off into the whole issue of who was going to control the Suez Canal. And if you were going to give over some solutions to the Suez Canal, you had to deal with the water problem.
I'm talking to Robert Collins on Backstory today. We are looking into Sudan and its leader, Omar Hassan Ahmad al-Bashir, who actually fought with the Egyptians against Israel during the October War, the Yom Kippur War in 1973. Was that through agreement with between Egypt and the Sudan, or was this something that al-Bashir did on his own because he believed in pan-Muslim struggle?
Oh, no, no. He was a very junior officer in 1973. In fact, he didn't become a brigadier until the year before the coup in 1988. And he was a good officer. He commanded the 8th Brigade fighting the Southerners for a whole year and a half, so the 8th Infantry Brigade. He had originally got his wings as in the airborne and then transferred to the infantry. And what occurred with the Yom Kippur War, the Arab-Israeli War of 1973, was that the Sudanese felt strongly that they had to send some of their units, and I might add here that until the latter part of this century, the Sudan had the finest Arab army outside of the Jordan Legion, British trained, really top, and their officer class was extremely professional, first rate. And they said that it was necessary for them to send some battalions to help their brother Egyptians. Which they did do, and Bashir was just an officer, junior officer in one of the brigades, in one of the battalions that went to fight in the Sinai. I might add, just as an anecdote, a footnote, that the Israelis have told me on numerous occasions that in the Yom Kippur War, the only ones that they really feared were the Sudanese. And they said, put simply, they would never surrender, they would never retreat. We had to annihilate them.
Has the favor been returned? Do Sudan's neighbors support it in its Islamization programs, or are they made uneasy by the way Sudan has handled its internal politics?
Well, I can assure you that until recently, when it softened very much, that the Egyptians, because President Mubarak, as we all know, is having, has always had a problem with his Islamists in Egypt, the Muslim Brothers. And in fact, it was the Muslim Brothers that first started up in the Sudan, which Tarabi more or less took over. And so all of the neighbors, certainly Egypt, and certainly the Africans to the south, Ethiopia, and even the Saudis, although they cooperate with the Sudan a great deal, they're very, very nervous about the Islamist trend in the Sudan.
Why did al-Bashir sign the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement to end the fighting after having put so much energy into winning the war with the South and obviously helping the Janjaweed do what they've been doing throughout Darfur and elsewhere?
Well, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which has brought peace, and it's now being attempting to be implemented, very difficult to do. But that was signed because clearly it was perfectly clear that the ragtime Sudan Army, despite the fact they were getting a lot of modern, sophisticated weaponry toys from the Chinese and the Czechs, with their oil money, there was no way that they were going to win the war in the South. And anybody who's ever been in the southern Sudan for any time, in about 15 minutes or in half an hour, when you look over this vast expanse of swamp and jungle and savanna lands, you can see that it'd be a terrible place to fight in, and indeed, he couldn't win the war. Everyone in the North knew this. So perhaps it was time to make peace. And also, by this time, the Islamists came to power in that June of 1989, and it secured it firmly by 1990-1991. And here they introduced all the hardline Islamist legislation and decrees, and they were a very small minority that was ruling largely by terror, who could keep the Sudanese in line. Well, an element within the National Islamic Front, which is the political party of the Islamists, many of them, and there are a lot of Sudanese who, and I can point this out, there are a lot of Sudanese who were not at all pleased to see Sharia just because they were Muslims. they realized it would be very difficult to implement in a very disparate country with 600 languages, 400 ethnic groups, and a third of whom were not Muslims. So these members became what you might call the moderate party. And the strong Islamists became a cabal within the government. Well, you couldn't ignore these moderates. And they said, look, the time has come to make a deal with the South. We need peace, and all the Sudanese, desperate for peace. When the commander of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, John Garang, came to Khartoum, and he's a southerner and a Christian, came to Khartoum sort of almost victoriously. They had culminated this peace. They had ended the war. He was greeted by a crowd of 2 million people. Incredible number of people in the Sudan, and many of them were Muslims.
Now, what about the slavery issue? It's said to persist in Sudan to the point of affecting 15,000 people. Does the government acknowledge that it even exists?
Well, they call it by a different name. They call it abductions. They don't want to believe that it exists, but of course it does. And
is this a matter of old custom, or is this something where money is being made?
No, it's a very old custom, and that's the point. You can't understand the slavery today unless you understand the real beginnings of it back in the 19th century, when approximately 30,000 Southerners, that's a rough figure, we don't have an exact figure, but it's a large number, 30,000 Southerners were rounded up and sent to the north for the slave markets of Khartoum, Cairo, in the Middle East, and the Persian Gulf.
And they had dark-skinned people being sent to work as slaves for lighter-skinned people.
Well,
is that simplifying it?
Because they were going to be cheap labor, concubines, do all the things that slaves perform.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Sudan's oil. Has that played a role in how foreign governments have dealt with al-Bashir?
Well, yes, it has. Oil, depending on how you look at it, can be a benefit or a curse. In this case, it's probably a curse, because the oil revenues, which now amount to just under $1 billion a year, Bashir thought that these revenues, which is, if you thought about it, really should be spent on building the infrastructure, schools, hospitals, that sort of thing. It was really a bonanza for what is essentially a pretty poor country. Here, he thought, once we have this oil money, we can go out and we can buy the modern arms which will tip the scale in an unwinnable war. And that's what he did do. All those revenues have gone to increase the war. What they didn't realize, or if they did, they ignored it, is that you can buy all the fancy weaponry you want. The Chinese will sell it very cheaply. The Czechs will give it away. The Ukrainians will fly your airplanes. The Russians will provide you with arms. But the one thing you have to realize, if you've got this rather sophisticated weapon, then you have to have somebody to be able to use it, to shoot it. And it's not simply a matter of buying the toys. It's a matter of those who can play with them, and that is not the case in the Sudan Army. Also, there's another thing to consider. During this whole conflict, this whole area of the southern Sudan, what little infrastructure, that is bridges, roads, schools, that sort of thing, that the British left behind have been pretty much destroyed. And so in this war, in the latter years of this war, what you found were MiG-29s flying over what was essentially a swamp and jungle without anything to shoot except a couple of cows. And you're not going to win a war in that kind of environment.
Thank you so much for talking with us about Omar Hassan Ahmad al-Bashir and the situation in Sudan as part of our backstory series. I've been speaking with Robert O. Collins, who's professor of history emeritus at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of numerous books, including 7 histories of the Sudan, Southern Sudan, and the Nile. What a pleasure it's been.
Fine. Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.